You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Turning the attention inward. Letting the body soften. Relaxing the jaw. Releasing the shoulders. Breathing into the belly. So just feeling yourself in a body, feeling the weight of the body, the density. We might connect with the feeling of the body as a field of energy. So just the kind of energies that move through. Letting the attention come to rest on the breath. You can feel the breath at the nostrils, the air coming in and out, that touch sensation. Or the movement of chest and belly, rising and falling. Our practice begins with this turning towards the elemental experience of life. Very simple aspects of experience. The breath. Sensations. Our thought world creates so many complications. And of course, we need thoughts. They serve many purposes. But this practice helps us to be less dominated by, controlled by thought, by teaching us to turn toward something that's not in that world. And through that, through the calming and clearing that comes with just being with the breath, another kind of wisdom, another kind of thought world, not dominated by self, not even really dominated by thought, but rather a more pure knowing. This reveals itself as we clear away the surface noise of the mind. We don't have to chase after it or look for it. And just allow it to appear, that clarity, in its own time and through its own process. There is a kind of purity in that mind. It's also very open and could say that it has an inherent tenderness to it. That tenderness evokes compassion, kindness from our hearts. Again, very naturally, not through any particular effort, just allowing that unfolding, that opening. And of course, tenderness is a kind of vulnerability. So we might find ourselves somewhat shying away from letting go, from opening, allowing ourselves to be touched in this way. This is where life is most real. Without the walls around our heart, without the thoughts and the judgments and the analyses, just that pure being. This is something essential. Worth making ourselves vulnerable to touch this and to be touched. A lot of stuff going on here at Vincente Avenue tonight. So someone asked me to turn on the transcription. So that's probably on your screen now. And I'm sorry that kind of came late. It was, I saw it right when I stopped speaking in the guided meditation. So it wasn't much help for the guided meditation. And actually that's something we had been asked to do a while ago, so maybe it's something I can try to remember, or someone could try to remind me to do in the future. Thank you, Angela.
We've been for those who have not been with us for these last 18 months, is it? Something like that. I've been going through my book One Breath at a Time, and we're getting towards the end of step 10. And we're on a little section called the Dukkha of Maintenance. Dukkha is the word that we translate as suffering. And so when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, so where you, it's translating the word dukkha. That doesn't necessarily refer to severe suffering. Sometimes I think that, there's other words that can be useful, like unsatisfactory. That's a good translation. Lee Brazington makes a sort of extended argument for saying that the best translation of dukkha is bummer. So his new book, which is not published yet, has a long section on that. It's quite funny, but also a good argument. So this dukkha of maintenance is talking about just the kind of challenge of taking care of your life, starting with taking care of your body, you know, and I don't know, for some reason it starts out with this story about my father and how sort of routine he was, you know, how he did everything exactly the same, it seemed every day, it was sort of like same thing over and over, and then I kind of hated that when I was growing up, and then I found myself in my 20s becoming very routine and structured, and of course like that, you know, I'm just like my father thing, you know, that happens to people. Either your mother or your father, or you're exactly the opposite of them or something. Our lives, of course, are very often a response to who our parents were, if we knew our parents. I guess I'll read a little bit of this. I'm not going to read the part about my father. So the Buddha identified different kinds of dukkha. One of them, the one that relates to step 10, is the dukkha of maintenance. This is the tedium that comes with daily life. Having to wash ourselves, brush our teeth, eat, clean dishes, clean clothes, go to the bathroom, exercise, sleep. Over and over, we repeat these activities, many of them daily, spending our lives performing repetitive duties that serve only to sustain our existence, seemingly adding little pleasure or meaning to life. Thanks so much. Even on retreat, where our focus is on doing nothing but meditation, we find that these maintenance needs constantly intrude. That's one of the things that struck me when I've been on meditation retreat, and when I've gotten like really into my practice where all I want to do is sit, and then it just seems like it keeping interrupted. Damn, I gotta go to the bathroom. Damn, it's time to eat again. Jeez, we're doing that all the time. It's interesting when you fast. I'm sure some of you have fasted a little bit. I'm terrible at fasting, but a few times I've done it, I was just struck by how much more time there was in the day when I didn't have to cook or clean the dishes, all that, you know, just, and you're sort of like, well, what am I going to do with all this time? But maybe you could meditate. And I have this aside in here about friends who have taught meditation in prison say that something similar happens. Their prisoners often say, I'd like to start meditating every day, but I can't find the time. Anyway, just as we have to maintain our bodies in this disciplined and somewhat tedious way, so as the Big Book points out, must we maintain our spiritual life. Daily meditation is a cornerstone of any 12-step program in any Buddhist practice. And just like doing dishes or washing your clothes, it can come to seem like a tedious duty. I don't know. This is like a really weird section. Sometimes I read parts of this book and I go, what's my point here? I don't know. It's like, you should floss. We get to that. The next paragraph is about flossing. So it's good. Good advice always. But, and like kind of comparing meditation to flossing, you know, I like flossing your brain every day. It's a good idea. Keep your brain clean so you don't get any cavities in your brain. God. No, but I mean, it is really interesting because I claim to be lazy in my own way. And I'm just not that interested in like having things be a certain way. That's why, you know, a typical, and maybe there's kind of a typical dynamic between my wife and myself that probably is founded in, you know, male, you know, patriarchy, that like, I don't care about painting the house. I don't care what color it is. So she gets to pick all the colors, but then she has to put in all this time and energy into it. And I'm like, that's just dukkha, you know, leave it alone. I can sort of claim to somehow be above it all, but of course the house gets painted and it looks nice. And then I didn't have to do anything. So it's pretty lame. I don't know. I thought I was going to have something to say tonight, but it doesn't look like I do so far. Could change. See if I can work something up here. It's just, you know, it's interesting having this, you know, speaking of sort of the dukkha of maintenance, this class is kind of a maintenance for all of us. And it's been, you know, going on and on. And some days like are not great days to be a Dharma teacher. It's not even like a bad day. It's just that the things that I'm interested in today or that I was engaged in today, particularly, you know, are a little, outside of what I would probably teach. But, you know, here I am showing up, which is, you know, the best I can do sometimes is just to show up and meditate with you guys. I'll tell you what set me off today, because I don't have anything else to say. So last night, you know, when I'm doing the dishes, which I usually do the dishes, just FYI, in case you think I'm just a bum around the house, you know, I take care of the kitchen. I usually put on music, and we have these nice Sonos speakers. And the last couple of nights I've been putting on 60s pop music, you know, just really like feel good stuff. And last night the song Hair came on, which is, as you know, was from, as you should know, was from the great Broadway production called Hair. Anyway, it's a pretty funny song, you know, is the aversion by the cow sills. My wife and I actually saw the cow sills a couple of years ago over in Marin. My friend was playing guitar. My old friend from my hometown is playing guitar for the Box Tops. And so he got us tickets for this, like, you know, 60s show. Anyway, cow sills are really good. Who knew? Anyway, it got me thinking about my hair. I used to have hair. I should find a picture of myself. I had really long, super long hair. I was like the longest hair in town, you know. In fact, I got arrested because I had long hair, because the police realized I was a hippie and I probably had drugs, and they were right. So anyway, that was an illegal arrest, by the way. So, and there's no record of it because it didn't really happen. So, but what I was thinking about was, how did I wind up so messed up by 1969, you know? And because I've often sort of told, when I tell my story, my recovery story, I usually say, oh, I had a really nice childhood. And then, I don't know, like puberty hit or something, and I just got depressed, or it's genetic or something. And this morning in my meditation, I started thinking about it. And my past like opened up in a way that it hadn't ever. And I saw what had happened to me, and it was really revealing. And I wound up calling my older brother, one of my older brothers, and telling him about it. Because this is one of my brothers who will really talk about that stuff and engage in it. And what it is that, you know, I was the youngest of five boys. And when I was really young, like under 10 years old, you know, I thought that my brothers were just like the stars of the world. You know, they were my heroes. And I felt like the world I lived in was this like perfect world. Like, you know, the things that I saw as being like defining who we were like, you know, where my father went to college and then my older brother went there, Notre Dame, you know, so we rooted for Notre Dame. That was special. And my father worked for the steel company, and the steel company was wonderful, you know. And we belonged to a country club, you know, and it was all like, you know, so wonderful. And then my brother, who I called today, dropped out of college, dropped out of Yale, you know, and came home and started to see a psychiatrist. And I was like 9 years old or 10 years old. And there started to be these cracks in my family. The conflict between him and my mother just was vicious. And within 2 years later, 2 years, my next older brother dropped out of college and went in the army, which was like really strange in our family because we were like not really that kind of military family. And then my next older brother dropped out of college, and my mother had a nervous breakdown, went in the mental hospital, you know. And by the time I was 14 or 15, it was like my image of what my family was and what my life was shattered, and I didn't know who I was. And I wound up, and all I had was music and then rock and roll and drugs and sex and, you know, counterculture. And it was like, oh, this is who I'll be. Because it was like, really, identity was just destroyed. And of course I got depressed, you know, like, yeah, of course you were living in a dream and, you know, whatever. I certainly had no, capacity. I didn't have any internal strength. You know, I didn't have any personal power. It was like I had invested all of my power in this illusion. And then when it got broken, I didn't have anything to fall back on. I didn't have any resilience. It was such a privileged upbringing, you know, for me to feel self-pity about it or to, you know, at all. It's like ridiculous because I was given everything in the world. And then I was like, oh, fuck this. I don't want it because it's not what I thought it was. Anyway, that kind of was very powerful for me because I came to as I say, to understand how I became an alcoholic, among other things, how my life took this turn that I had never understood. And now it makes perfect sense. And I can't feel compassion for what I went through. And it is painful to think about. But on the other hand, here I am, you know, in this comfortable existence where I'm, you know, really living, you know, a second life of privilege, and you know, to be a Dharma teacher. And just like, it's the easiest job in the world, you know, especially now with Zoom. You don't even have to go see people. Just go into the basement for an hour. So I don't know, Angela, if we will keep this recording, because I'm not sure I really want, I don't mind sharing it with people, but I'm not really sure that I want it like out in the world. Beyond this, we'll see. And I hope it's just not a waste of your Friday night to hear that story. Maybe my hope always, and of course, this is the principle of sharing in a meeting, is that maybe I'm saying something that's kind of triggers something for you about your life, you know, like just to, I mean, because obviously, like having some understanding of how we got here, especially as addicts, you know, sometimes it's very obvious, you know, people who really experience obvious trauma, or there's addiction really prevalent in their family. But for many of us, you know, middle class, privileged white people, it's like, what's your excuse? You know, like what, you know, why you had everything given to you and then you just screwed it up. Like what's, you know, why should we care? And it can, I think, be mysterious for us to sort of understand how we got there. It's just as mysterious as how did we survive it? You know, how did we come back? Which is also a question many of us ask ourselves, like, how did I get out of that hole? You know? So there you go. I will leave it at that for now and see if anybody wants to chime in and say hi and, you know, share anything of your own or something.
You have some nice messages in the chat.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. That's nice.
I'm going to post the Donna information. So I just, before oh, yeah. I find quick, it all. But,
well, people are saying nice things. Quick, ask him for money.
Yeah. No, I always post it once you open it up.
Am I grateful to her and the house getting painted? Boy, am I ever. I mean, I have a really great partner. I'm really, really fortunate in that. We're very, you know, we've been together a long time, and she's not a Buddhist, you know, which is probably good. And we kind of complement each other, I think. I'll read about attachment theory. Yeah, thanks. I have a friend who wrote a book about attachment theory. I try to stay away from that kind of stuff, but thank you for the suggestion, Dana. All right, we got hands up. That's what I like to see. The best line in the song Hair is, you know, that the reason he doesn't cut his hair, it's not for lack of bread like the Grateful Dead. I just thought I would say that because the word grateful was in there. It made me think of that. So, not for lack of bread like the Grateful Dead. Who had their hand up first? Sasha, I've been watching your face for some reason. So there you go.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Hi, everyone. I really enjoyed your talk today. I mean, I'm calling in from Melbourne, Australia, and I have been in recovery for a long time, and what I really enjoyed about what you had to say was I'd never thought about the dukkha of tedium. And I know that sometimes with my program, it does feel really tedious, and doing the same things over and over again and thinking, oh my God, the 10th step, here we are again, you know, working through those questions. So it was really lovely to hear that, because I haven't gotten to that part in your book yet. So I really appreciated that perspective. And I've just gone through a bit of a transition between jobs, and I'm a student at the moment, and I'm finding it really hard to get my rhythm. Like, I'm feeling really lazy and sort of finding it hard to be motivated. So today's meditation and talk were really good for me. So thank you very much.
Yeah, boy, it is. It can be really hard to transition back into school or work when you've had time off, and I think these, you know, this time, this the time of the pandemic, just everything is kind of hard, so really understandable. Yeah, dukkha of maintenance, or I like that, dukkha of tedium. You know, I think the one thing we can kind of take away from mindfulness is, can I just be present for those things, you know? And that's one of the things we try to learn on retreats, right? To just mindfully brush your teeth and mindfully, you know, eat your rice, and to find the joy in the simple things. Because otherwise, there is this way in which life is just waiting for the next thing to happen. And, you know, I think about travel like that, like how travel is all about getting to a place where you aren't there, and so it's like the whole time of travel has no value. It's just written off as just, I have to go through this in order to get there. And, you know, and I mean, when you are just actually in the act of traveling rather than, like, you know, on a vacation travel. But anyway, thank you. And congratulations, Australia is doing so well in the Olympics. You guys, great in the summer Olympics. Definitely. We have my wife teaches at a college where Patty Mills went to school, if you know who he is, right? And so we're big fans of his. Patty and Matthew Dellavedova both went there, St. Mary's College. And Jock Lundin, what's his last name? Jock, anyway, the center, he's going to the NBA. Anyway, sports talk radio, I could just switch into that mode. Dan, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, more or less. I have to start being a teacher again on Monday, so, you know, little bit of stress there, getting everything ready. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to, you know, thank you for that. Actually, sharing that story at the end about, you know, like coming up and, you know, kind of some of the story of why you became an alcoholic and all that. And it really actually made me think about it in a different way too for myself. Because I think, like, what you were saying is, like, we all need something to drive us, to attach to give ourselves meaning. Mm-hmm. So like for myself in elementary school, I was just like a teacher's pet. It was great. Mm-hmm. I was a smart kid. But sometime around middle school, like that just didn't work anymore. School was boring. And I didn't want to, like, I just didn't identify with anybody, teachers or all that. But then, you know, along comes rock and roll and weed, and like, okay, now I've got something again. And you know, with my personality, I dove headlong into it.
Yeah. Well, it's also like my greater theory of addiction, about that childhood for people who have non-abusive childhoods is magical. And then when we start to come of age, we realize, oh,
life isn't magical. Where's the magic? And drugs and alcohol are magical. And so we, with our adolescent brains that aren't like sort of mature enough to figure out how to, you know, really embrace life as it really is, we find that, you know, the second stage of magic of drugs and alcohol. And then if that carries over into adulthood, then we got a problem. Thank you. Deborah, I think you had your hand up.
Yes, I did. Thank you, Kevin. I really enjoyed you telling that story because it makes me think of my own situation with that. And just like Dan was saying, you know, started and, you know, I was doing some reading on belief systems, what we grew up with and how, you know, this is what we bring into our adulthood. And some of it is just so inappropriate or not right for us. You know, and I found, you know, pot and boys and, you know, drugs, it was like, wow, you know, this is the way to live. This is living. You know? And,
right. Yeah. I figured it out.
Yeah. Wow. This is all it takes. And I just want to be happy.
Yeah.
Most of my family, I come from a bunch of Sicilians who are mostly women, and all their marriages were had a problem of some sort, and they just stayed there and stayed there and stayed there. And I just couldn't understand why they stayed in their misery. And so when I was able to, and by that time I had already discovered these wonderful things, or so I thought they were wonderful, and just took off. I left home early and came to the side of the world. And anyway, so, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about that same thing about, you know, my mom wasn't a bad person. She really wasn't. And, but she did the best she could, but it still wasn't what a little girl needed, right? Especially being raised with a single parent. It was very difficult in hearing all these women talk about how awful men were. And I saw a lot of things, you know, a 6 and 7 year old girl shouldn't see, or shouldn't witness. But anyway, I just wanted to kind of give that background. And I always thought that I would be the perfect parent when I had a child. I was going to be the perfect parent because I knew what not to do. But of course, I was an addict by that time. So how can an addict know the right thing to do while raising a child, right? And probably needless to say, my daughter became an addict as well. She didn't go too far down the rabbit hole, but she went far enough to give the whole family pause, or not the family, just her dad and I pause and try to do our best. And that's when I got clean. I got clean for her. But as I'm in recovery, though, you know, and I see her as an adult, she's 26 now, and I got clean when, you know, she was 16. So, you know, and I think about the ways that I wasn't a good mom, you know, I have these visions of incidences that I could have done so much better. And I could have, I probably hurt her with my anger or whatever it was. A lot of the ways that a lot of the her shortcomings, I blame on myself. If I did this, if I did that, and not that, and if I did not do this, and if I, you know, going through that whole rigmarole.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that because it brings me back to my own story of that, you know, I wasn't raised perfectly either. And I had a lot of things, like I said, that I didn't, I shouldn't have seen at the ages I saw them at or hear the things. And I had to go through that like you did with figuring out, oh, this, what I'm raised to believe, this belief system is full of shit. And I have to find it out myself. And I brought that into my daughter's life. So seeing that is helping me be okay with the guilt that I have, and I still have, but I have had a lot worse over the years of working this out, that I wasn't such a bad mother, really. So it, you know, it does go from generation to generation. It's not just about us, but as how we are as parents, I think. I'm quiet now.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I was thinking about, you know, I was sober when I became a father. So I was pretty sure that I couldn't do anything particularly wrong. And now it turns out my daughter thinks that maybe I was not a perfect father, and I'm going to have to straighten her out about that. But not sure where she's coming from. Kids these days. Joe, off there in the mountains. Oh, no, you're not off in the mountains. You're in a room. It's disappointing.
It is disappointing. The mountains aren't far away, though, Kevin.
Well, the mountains are not really where you want to be right now in California. From we were supposed to, I guess I probably already said that, we were supposed to go up there and up to Tahoe. When we checked the air quality today, it was like 303 AQI. It's like, oh, that's not breathable. No, forget it.
I agree. Looking out my window, it's 200 AQI right now for 2.5 stuff.
Not great.
So I had a reflection on the dukkha of maintenance.
Yeah.
This is kind of eye-opening for me a few months ago when I was listening to Steven Snyder and Tina Rasmussen on Rick Hansen's program.
Oh.
And they both said something along the lines of, you know, things are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But then they also said, you know, about 85% of the things are just plain neutral.
Right.
So I started thinking about that, and I thought about it in the context of meditation. And because a lot of meditation seems to me is just being comfortable with the same neutral object appearing over and over again. There's my breath again, right? And I think it really has something to say to people who are AA types, in which I include myself, in the sense that seeking excitement, I think, is really a root of a lot of behavior that I myself might not want. And when I started adjusting to the idea of things being more neutral and not needing to be excited all the time, then I can start practicing much better. So I just thought I would throw that out.
Thank you. You know, I actually have thought about this idea of the breath as being neutral and why that might be of value. And so I'll just give you my little, it's not exactly a theory, but it's an observation. Equanimity is a mind state in which we are not disturbed or distracted by the pleasant or the unpleasant. And so if we can get our mind to a place that is essentially neutral, then we can enter into this state of equanimity, which is actually the main feature of the fourth jhana. So I think this is one of the reasons why the Buddha gave the breath as a meditation object, because if you get absorbed into something that's neutral, you go into an equanimous state. You're not being drawn by anything pleasant or unpleasant. You're just absorbed in neutral, which is actually takes you into equanimity, which actually the state of the fourth jhana is actually surpassingly pleasant, but it's not sensually pleasant. So it doesn't have the distracting quality of a hindrance. You know, there's no craving in it. There's no attachment in it. It's just deep, deep peace. So interesting that, like, by working with a neutral object, then that can actually open the door to going into a deeper state. Anyway, I'm not sure I explained that quite properly, but since there's one more hand up, I want to give Stella a chance to speak.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Really nice to be here. This is my first class I'm attending live. Mm-hmm. Watched a couple of recordings. Well,
it's usually much better than this, so don't worry.
No, I thought it was great. So I'm new, and I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but I want to throw it out there in case anyone can help. I'm looking for a Buddhist 12-step program, and I didn't know if there is one. I found some that seem like they kind of you use them alongside a 12-step program, but I didn't know if there was one that can just be the program itself that somebody would recommend.
Well, I don't know that there is. I mean, first of all, you sort of can't have a Buddhist 12-step program because 12-step programs are supposed to be not affiliated with any sect or denomination. So you know, I've kind of keep my own teaching as being a sort of, you know, something else. But it's not what I offer isn't really a program because I got sober in AA. And so I feel like, well, what am I going to do that's going to be better than that? There are two Buddhist recovery programs that, or maybe three that I can name for you. There are two that are very closely related. Refuge Recovery, which gave birth to Recovery Dharma when the founder of Refuge Recovery got in some trouble over sexual misconduct. So people branched off. And anyway, Refuge Recovery and Recovery Dharma are non-12-step based in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And then there's a program called 8-Step Recovery. And the 8-Step is not related to the 12 steps at all. It's completely other 8 steps. But the three of them are easily found, Googled, and meetings for all of them are also listed on the Buddhist Recovery Network website. So BuddhistRecovery.org. Where you'll find like more meetings. What I do is more like, this isn't exactly a meeting because I'm the teacher here. And so it's not just a place where people share, but it's, and I think there is one of the problems in my mind with a Buddhist recovery program is that recovery programs are usually done as kind of self-help. Whereas Buddhism depends upon teachers and authorities, it's difficult. If you just have a peer-led Buddhist group, it can be a little risky with kind of the blind leading the blind a little bit. Buddhism is a pretty dense topic that can be easily misunderstood. And so that if you just have a bunch of people that are reading a book and then trying to understand it without a teacher's guidance, it can kind of get confusing, to say the least. So, but those are some thoughts for you. I was going to say that was the end, but since Deborah J has put her hand up, I cannot, you know, say goodnight without hearing from her. Can you unmute yourself, Deborah?
I was going to say was that the group that I'm involved in Santa Barbara started as Refuge Recovery, and we've been together for almost 2 years. They were together before me. I've been involved 2 years. And they started as Refuge Recovery, but people had been in the group for like 3 or 4 years and we're bored with reading the book over and over.
Yeah.
And in Refuge Recovery, that's the only reference you have. So we dropped the name, dropped the affiliation, because we wanted to read other people, like Kevin Griffin's One Breath at a Time.
And we're almost done with it now. And we meet once a week, which, you know, is okay. I'd love more. But most of the people in the group came through AA and then went to Buddhism. And now I kind of think that we're a Buddhist recovery book study group. in that, because we're finishing your book, we have to choose another book.
Right.
So we meditate, read from the book, and then share. And it's a wonderful little meeting. We had to go on Zoom to do it, but, you know, we've still kept up. So that's all.
That's great. Yeah. And I think a lot of, a lot of groups have kind of come together like that, like just sort of, you know, sort of ad hoc. What else was I going to say? I was trying to find it. Someone asked for a picture with my hair, but I was trying to find one, but I'm not. I found my picture with Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is really a great picture, but but neither of us has hair in that picture. I know. I was going to say to Stella that we do have a list of people who just like a contact list. Oh, it's right there. It is right there. So if you're interested in connecting with some of the other people in this group, because this is, there's kind of a, I could say like a regulars. I don't want to know if I want to call them a core group, but there's a group of regulars that come here that have been doing this with me for the last year and a half. And many of them, or a good number of them, have, done retreats with me before as well. So.